Chapter 16. Laura. Session number 8. 3 months ago. New York City. Dr. Brody.
Can't you see his cruelty?
Laura.
Who? Mitch Adler? Cruelty is a harsh word. He was just a high school jerk-off playing his options.
Dr. Brody.
He knew he was causing you pain. It wasn't incidental to his selfish actions. It was intentional. And that is cruelty.
Laura.
He seemed troubled to me, and I was drawn to him because of it. Like I could make it better if I just broke through. If I loved him enough.
Dr. Brody.
You thought you could fix him and then he would be able to love you?
Laura.
I know that sounds ridiculous. I see that now. He was never going to love me.
Dr. Brody.
Does that remind you of someone else? Someone from your childhood?
Laura.
I don't think so. What are you getting at?
Dr. Brody.
Sometimes we try to fix the past by fixing the present.
Laura.
Well, that's stupid.
Dr. Brody.
It's how our brains work. It's subconscious, and it's not stupid.
Laura. But it's dangerous. Dr. Brody.
Yes. It can be very dangerous.
Chapter 17. Laura. The night before. Thursday, 10 p.m. Branston, Connecticut.
I know what you did. You should never have come back. You will pay.
The notes came at different times and in different places. The first was folded under the windshield wiper of Rosie's minivan when I took it to the track to run. Round and round in circles I ran. The car parked just up a small hill in the lot of the public high school of the town next door. A town that has schools with good facilities and no guards at the gate, because why would they? That's why people pay millions of dollars for a house there. I wonder what they would think if they knew their poor security let in people like me, people who may have killed someone. I run each lap in 2 minutes. Whoever left that note was watching me, waiting for me to make a turn around the bend away from the lot. The second came in a package from Amazon. It was slipped between the openings where the box hadn't been taped. It was a box with pajamas, which I'd ordered online and had shipped to Rosie's house. The third I found under my pillow. They were typed on white paper, cut off after the words, then folded several times like origami.
Why don't you lock your doors? I asked Rosie the day I found the third note. Aren't you worried someone might steal something?
Rosie gave me her classic Rosie look of, are you kidding? We were in the kitchen. She swept her arms out in front of her with a great deal of drama.
I wish they would. Half this stuff is crap from our old house and Joe's old house. Everything is old. Take it. Take it all. Just not the wine.
Ha-ha. I laughed with her, then went upstairs and sat on the bed in the attic, staring at the door and the window and the closet where I'd just hidden the last note. Or the latest note. That was 2 days ago. Maybe there were more coming, or maybe something else. I should be worried about the notes and not this stranger who sits beside me. Maybe I am. Maybe that's why I haven't slept more than 2 hours at a stretch since the first one arrived. Exhaustion in my bones, in my brain. The thick fog is not helping me as the stranger and I pull into the underground garage. I've been talking about that night to this stranger. Jonathan Fielding. The night of the party in the woods. I don't stop. His name was Mitch Adler. He went to the public high school, and I'd met him at a party 6 months earlier. He was not a nice boy. He was not a good boyfriend. But I told myself there were reasons, and that I was the only person who could fix him.
You probably read that he came to the party with a girl, I say.
Jonathan nods.
He doesn't want to cause another freakout where he has to risk his life chasing me through a dangerous park. Then he says,
his parents said it was the girl he'd been seeing all year, bringing her to the house for dinners. They said they thought she was his girlfriend.
And he continues,
and they said they had never met you or heard your name until that night.
Jonathan Fielding, you have done your homework. I add to his research. Her name was Brittany. Blonde hair, blue eyes. Turns out she had been his real girlfriend for over a year. I had no idea. I thought I was his girlfriend. He had sex with her in his car before they went into the woods to join the party. I say, that's the truth. The car was there. I was parked up the road from the others.
Why?
He asks. Why what?
Why did he leave his car so far up the road?
I shrug. I don't know. Maybe he thought he would get lucky again. Then he looks at me.
But not with that same girl. Brittany, the one he'd already had sex with.
But with you.
Two girls in one night.
Fuck you, Jonathan Fielding. But yes. The car is off. We sit in the darkness of the windowless garage. And now, my mood. I don't know what he was thinking. He says nothing more, but I know what he's thinking. All of the facts are there for anyone to find, and I'm sure he's found them. I feel defensive. I'm back at the police station 11 years ago, blood on my clothes, splinters in my hand from holding onto that bat so tight, tears streaming down my dirty face, my dirty soul. I wasn't going to have sex with him in that car. I let him think that, but I wasn't going to have my first time be like that, in the backseat of a car with a jerk who'd brought someone else to a party, someone else named Brittany who happened to be his real girlfriend. Jonathan looks at me and smiles. It's not a warm smile.
What did you think was going to happen?
He asks. But it isn't really a question. I don't know what you mean, but I do know.
How are you going to fend him off? It seems dangerous.
He touches my arm and I see a glimpse of reassurance.
I'm not judging you. I just don't understand why you would leave with him. Go to his car. Get inside.
I wipe away every trace of an expression.
That was harsh.
He backs off. Now I see sympathy.
So what did happen?
It does not get past me that he never mentions the bat. He is not sold on my story the way the police were after they found the car and Lionel Casey. I'd been dating the guy. He was a shit. He asked me to do something, an ultimatum, a condition to keep him, and I was desperate. I thought if we were alone, if he saw how much I loved him, he would stop being a shit. I didn't know about Brittany, how he'd been with her for an entire year. I only knew he came and went in my life for months, and it was torture. I never knew when he would be there. I never knew when he would disappear. But when he did come back, it was intoxicating. Nothing else could touch that feeling. Didn't you ever run into a woman who made you feel that way? He thinks for a moment, but not really. The shrink was right. Normal people don't fall into traps like that. Only the broken ones.
I'm sure I would have if I hadn't met my wife so early, he says, lying, and I realize from this lie that he has the ability to be kind, because that's what that was, kindness. I was a broken, hot mess. I was that friend who everyone tries to help, but who won't listen to reason. Then he eases into another question. Why were you so drawn to him? To the shithead who only fed you scraps?
I have an answer. It's a lie. My father left when I was 12. Left us for another family. That probably has something to do with it. That's when it all started. It took me years to understand myself, what pieces were broken and why. It was such a relief when I finally sorted it out. This is a good lie. That Dick leaving was the start of my problems, my anger. The truth is that I was broken long before Dick left us. but Jonathan buys it and moves on.
So then what happened with that guy in New York? The one who disappeared?
That's a good question, Jonathan Fielding. I don't know. Honestly, he was the first man I thought was actually good, I say. Then I shrug and look sad. Truth, truth, truth. All of it true. Even the sadness.
So this must be hard for you, he says. Getting back into dating. You must be analyzing everything, even what I'm saying right now.
I wave my hand in circles like a magician. If only I had magical powers to see what's going on inside there. I smile. Try to sound playful. Our story turns a page. A new chapter begins.
Well, he says, it's not easy for me either, if that makes you feel better.
Yes, it does. Misery loves company. Misery beats empathy every time. How so? I ask. I want it to be bad. I want to hear how he suffered, so I don't feel so alone in my own suffering. I've been around Rosie and Joe and their marital bliss for too long.
I told you my mother died last year, right?
I nod. He did. I almost forgot, because I can be selfish that way, hearing only the part about how much his parents loved him and feeling the fury of envy from it. Exhaustion caused by chronic insomnia can make a person selfish.
It came soon after the divorce, maybe a month. My wife was at the funeral. Sorry, my ex-wife. I don't know why I keep doing that.
Neither do I. That must have been hard, I say. Both of us, we keep saying this. And I wonder if he was a patient of the same therapist. Ha ha ha.
When they lowered her casket into the ground, and I looked at my ex-wife across the grave, not beside me, it was just like watching all the love in my life go into the ground with her. It hasn't left me. That feeling I had, like it's all so fragile. The very thing that makes life worth living can be gone in an instant, and there's not a thing you can do about it.
Holy shit. I stare at him because he's closed his eyes and can't see me stare. And because he's crying. Not like a waterfall, just two or three drippy little tears. He blinks them away, opens his eyes again, and catches me staring. I look away. I'm sorry, I say. I didn't mean to stare. You just caught me off guard. He smiles and shakes his head.
All this talk about the meaning of life and these horrible events from our past and bad breakups. I guess these things don't come up that often in conversation, so I push them aside. Get up, go to work.
Check your likes and winks on findlove.com.
Exactly.
I exhale loudly so he knows I'm running alongside him on this emotional obstacle course. It's been a lot. I'm sorry. I've been in a very reflective place since I've come home. This is all my fault.
You know what's funny, though?
He asks. I have no idea. What?
It feels good in a way. Cathartic.
He knows how to turn the pages. I'm right there with him.
I know.
I haven't had one conversation since I've been home that's transcended mommy gossip, sports, and funny stories from our childhood. Always the funny stories, never the other ones.
Same here. Even when I visit my father or my sister, we don't ever talk about my mother, except to remember how she used to like this thing or that thing, or what she would have said about something happening in the news. None of us talks about the hole in our lives, or how it shines this bright light on death and loss. It's lonely sometimes.
Jonathan Fielding, you have no idea how lonely it is. Or maybe you do. Maybe you know in a different way, having had such incredible love from a parent and now having it gone. Maybe that's worse than spending a lifetime yearning for it. Maybe the hole that's left is just as big, and the urge to fill it with other things just as strong. I want to reach across the cheap plastic console of this car that's all wrong and put my arms around him. I want to bury my face in the nape of his neck and smell his skin and feel the warmth of him. This man who knows. This man who understands. I can hear Rosie scorning me.
Can't you see how these men are like a drug for you? Don't you get it? They can't fill the hole. They just make it bigger.
I'll quit tomorrow, Rosie. I promise. Just one more. I have to see if maybe this one's not wrong. His words, his tears. How can I still not know the difference? I learned not to turn them away, the right ones. I learned how to see through the wrong ones, not construct them into more than they are. Didn't I? Is it wrong that I see asshole across from me now? Jonathan Fielding reads my mind again.
What was his name? He asks.
Who?
The man in New York. The one who left you, who disappeared.
Asshole, I'm about to say. But that's probably not the best answer.
Kevin, I say.
True, but the word is bitter on my tongue.
There's a pause, a long one, and he stares at me now.
Payback's a bitch. Then I feel a line slowly drawn down my cheek, just one. It curls around my chin and stays there until I wipe it away.
Jesus, now I'm sorry, he says.
His hand reaches across the cheap plastic console of this car that's all wrong and wipes my cheek, erases the line with smooth, soft skin.
Both of us crying. I don't know what that says about this date.
I don't even try to smile this time.
He hurt you pretty bad, huh?
Apparently, I manage to get out as the muscles around my mouth tremble. I don't know why. It only lasted a few months. We're still in this car. Half an hour later, and we're still sitting here in the darkness. I feel trapped suddenly, like I'm in a cell with no way out. But there is a way out. It's a door handle, then an exit sign, then a street, then Rosie's car. The way home, the driveway, front door, unlocked, of course. Lingering garlic. Up the creaky stairs, down the narrow hall to the attic and my bed, where I will fall into the fluffy comforter that smells like my nephew, and I will lie there awake all night. It's just another cell. This is what I realize as I sit in the car that's all wrong, with this stranger, and this hope, and these tears. It's a cell where I stare at the ceiling in a state of fear about who was writing me ugly notes, and why did Kevin leave me without a trace, and when will I ever turn off this mind that is killing me in a million small ways every day? Which cell is worse? I decide to stay.
Was he the first one you thought you got right? Jonathan asks. After figuring out your issues with your father?
I move my head up and down. Yes. I hear Kevin's words in my ear. I love you. I feel his skin on my skin, and his hands in my hair, and his breath so warm against my cheek. He said those words even though I had told him everything about that horrible night, about my fists for hands and my father who left and my mother with her men, Rosie and Joe, and Mitch Adler. He said the words in spite of everything. He broke it off in a text message, I say.
I don't know why.
It makes me sound pathetic.
Just like that?
Jonathan asks, even though I already told him this. Just like that. I guess I have to keep saying it to convince him. Jonathan Fielding shakes his head with wide eyes, like I've just told him something unbelievable. But he doesn't know my past. How many wrong men I'd managed to find in the haystack, and how they treated women, or me, I suppose. Maybe it was just me.
That's just wrong. Breaking up with a text. I don't care what day and age it is. I sure hope it works out between us, because I don't know if I can handle the modern world.
You've already been stalked. You got through that. I think you'll be okay, I say, trying to move away from this story. I can't bear it. Not tonight. I'm so tired. Jonathan pulls the keys from the ignition and grabs his wallet from the cheap plastic console. He opens his door and the dome light turns on, making both of us squint.
Why don't you come up for a drink? I feel like I want to keep talking to you, but it's silly to be sitting in the car in a garage. I have a decent view.
Hell no. I know better than that. We could go back to the bar in Richmond. Maybe the stalker is gone, I suggest, like a nice church girl. He gets out of the car. He walks to my side and opens the door. He gives me his hand.
Come on, he says.
Something comes over him then. It's unbridled. It's strong and manly, and it sweeps me away like the ocean at the harbor. I give him my hand and leave the car, close the door, stand beside him. He looks me in the eye. The tears gone. The questions answered.
Come on,
he says again.
You're safe. It's not the third date yet.
Another page. A new chapter. This one has a title I'm familiar with. Mischief. It's a title I like, that old me likes, and I cannot refuse her. Not after everything I've just put her through. Old me rushes out the back door like a dog who's been stuck inside all day, running free on the lawn, sun shining on her face.
I may be safe, I tell him.
But you may not be. Ha ha.
Chapter 18. Rosie, present day, Friday, 11 p.m., Branston, Connecticut. The house was quiet. This time it was Joe in the bed with Mason beside him. They didn't even bother putting him down in his own room. Even after an hour at the park with Zoe, Mason could feel things weren't right in the house. Kids are like animals that way, sensing the storm before even one cloud appears in the sky. Joe was in the bed, but he was not asleep. He was on his laptop, quietly searching for men named Jonathan Fields. Back in the kitchen, at the table with Laura's laptop open, Rosie stared at the message inbox for their fake findlove.com account. There was nothing new, not from Second Chance or anyone else they'd contacted. Sometime between seeing those notes and this moment, the cells in her body had shifted. The shock and terror at the thought of Laura being gone, maybe forever, and in some horrible way, had morphed into something else. Not quite resignation, like she'd seen on Gabe's face. Not the feigned concern of the police. It was a mosaic of pain and sadness, fear and anger. She could taste them all as her thoughts shifted through scenarios. Laura missing, never found. Laura found, hurt or worse. She couldn't even think the other word. The tragedy was starting to take hold, progressing through stages. She suddenly had a window into the aftermath for parents whose children go missing, every day wondering, every day hoping, every day mourning. That could be her life now. The thought was unbearable. She rested her head in her palms, elbows propped on the table. How did people learn to go on after something like this? She thought about the parents of Mitch Adler, how they had learned to live with the loss of their son, their only son in between two daughters, a giant hole ripped into their family. That teenage boy, barely a man, whom Rosie could still see clearly in her memories, just gone. He was not a nice boy. Chances were he would not have grown into a nice man. Still, whatever his life held, that life was ended on a gravel road, a crushed skull, blood pooling around it, and Laura, standing there. They didn't stay long, his family. They had relatives in Colorado and were gone before Christmas. Rosie searched for them and couldn't find any trace back in Connecticut. Still, they had friends here. Mitch had friends as well, many of whom had likely stayed or returned. Any one of them might have seen Laura in town. Any one of them could have sent those notes. Rosie thought about what she might do if it had been Laura lying on the ground instead. If she might hunt down the person she thought was responsible. It was far less satisfying to believe that the killing was at the hands of a mentally ill hermit, a man who could not be held accountable. Justice must have felt very hollow to the Adler family. She heard her phone ring on the counter by the sink, and she was there in an instant.
Gabe, what's happened? Tell me.
Gabe's voice sounded tired. The waitress called. The one from the harbor bar who waited on Jonathan Fields and one of his dates, he said. She found the credit card slip.
The date who bought drinks with her own credit card?
It was 3 weeks ago, like the bartender said. Her name is Sylvia Emmett. Rosie's hand pressed into her chest. Rosie?
Yeah, I'm here. I want to speak to her. Can you get a number?
I did. I left a message. I gave her both of our numbers. She could be in bed already. It's late.
Rosie was walking now, around the island. What if we go there? Or the police? They could go. We can't wait all night. My God, Gabe.
He interrupted her. The police? You called them? Rosie stopped walking.
I did. It was time.
What did they say? Did they?
Nothing. They didn't seem to know who she was, and they weren't too concerned either. They said they would try to get the phone records by morning.
The line was silent for a long moment. Then, it's good you called, Rosie. You're right. It was time. Another abrupt shift swept through her. She didn't want to be right. She wanted Gabe to tell her she was overreacting, tell her she should have waited, tell her she was wrong. Then she remembered the notes Joe had found in Laura's coat pockets. The threats. Gabe didn't know about those, either.
There's something else,
she started to say. But another call was coming through. Rosie? Gabe was waiting for her to finish.
Hold on. There's another call. Maybe it's that woman.
Go. Pick it up.
Rosie answered the second call. Hello?
This is Sylvia Emmett,
the woman said it in a whisper. She said it like she didn't want to be on the other end of the call. Rosie took Joe's car to the west side of town. The streets were quiet, empty. There was nothing there but industrial buildings, warehouses, and car dealerships. She passed a furniture outlet and saw the neon lights of a diner. She turned in and parked, walked inside, and sat across from a woman with dark brown hair pulled up in a ponytail. She was young, like Laura, and pretty.
Are you Sylvia?
Rosie asked. The woman motioned for her to sit down.
Yeah,
she said. Rosie slid onto the bench, the table between them.
I'm Rosie. Thank you for calling back. You have no idea.
I have a boyfriend,
the woman blurted out.
He can't know.
The waitress was upon them. Sylvia ordered coffee.
I'll have the same, Rosie said.
Then to the woman.
My sister went on a date with a man last night. She never came home.
Sylvia sat back, wide-eyed.
What does that have to do with me?
Her phone was last online near a bar by the harbor. The bartender recognized this man. Rosie pulled the picture from her purse and laid it on the table. She pointed at Jonathan Fields and stared at his smug smile.
My sister went on a date with a man from this site. The profile matches, the age, description, and he was at the bar where her phone was last online.
Rosie watched the woman process the information, part of her hoping that she was about to say something that sent them on a new course, a course where this man, this player, was not the man her sister met. She couldn't decide if that would be better or worse. But it didn't matter. That hope was quickly dispelled as Sylvia's face changed from shock to recognition.
He loved that place. It was always crowded. Easy to get lost.
He said his name was Jonathan Fields, Rosie said.
Sylvia shook her head with disgust.
He lies about his name. I met him at a different bar, not through any dating site. I was out with some friends and he was there, alone. Trolling, it turns out. He was relentless, but cute. First he told me he was Billy Larson. But on our first actual date, which was at that bar by the harbor, he told me he had lied about that, and that his name was Buck Larkin. He covers his lies with more lies. After he told me he'd lied about his name, I thought that was it. That was the thing he was hiding. He said he didn't like women looking for him on social media. He said he was worried they might tell his ex-wife, and that it would hurt her feelings. Ridiculous, right? I didn't think it at the time. Not with handsome Billy, or Buck, or whatever his name really is, sitting across from me and two glasses of wine. The waitress returned and set down the coffee. Sylvia took hers in both hands, spun the cup around in the saucer. Her mind was on this man, Jonathan Fields, Billy Larson, Buck Larkin, the liar. Rosie didn't speak. She didn't want to interrupt the story for fear that it would end before it could lead her to her sister. And Sylvia seemed anxious to tell it all as quickly as she could.
We went on 3 dates in total, if you count the night we met,
Sylvia continued.
The first 2 times he was a perfect gentleman, paid for the drinks, paid for dinner the second night, opened doors for me, listened to me. He was the reason I had doubts about my boyfriend, you know? He was everything Dan isn't. But when I look back on it, I can see how he paid careful attention to everything I said. And yes, I lied about still being with Dan. But we're not married. We don't live together. I don't know. Maybe I'm just as bad as he is.
She stopped, took a sip of coffee. It felt like forever. So what happened? Rosie asked finally. Why did you agree to meet me in the middle of the night? Sylvia looked up, suddenly hesitant.
Please,
Rosie said. I need to know what might have happened last night.
Look, I don't know if this is going to help you find your sister. It's hard to talk about it. It's humiliating.
I don't think any of us get through life without doing something humiliating. Sylvia smiled softly, exhaled, looked into her coffee.
I just wanted to be sure, you know, about Dan. Before we got married or had kids. I'd never thought about it until I met Buck at that bar. He was so attentive, you know. And Dan, well, he's not exactly a talker. It made me wonder if I was rushing into things. I had feelings for this guy instantly. He was emotional and intelligent. He even cried when he told me about his divorce.
So Jonathan Fields, Rosie said, thinking out loud. I mean, Buck, or whoever he is, this man,
she pointed again at his picture.
He liked to talk.
You have no idea how good he is. It was as though he could read my mind. Everything I brought up, he had something clever or insightful to say about it. He never looked bored or antsy. Intellectual, well-read, you know? I honestly thought I was falling in love with him right then and there by the end of the 3rd date. That night, we met at a place downtown.
On Richmond?
Rosie asked.
Near there, on Main, 1 block over.
The car my sister was driving was found on Richmond. Did you go to his apartment?
Sylvia shook her head.
No, but he asked me to go there, all 3 times I saw him. We talked for hours. I told him it was too soon for me to go to his place, maybe next time. This whole thing about sex on the 3rd date, it's ridiculous, and I wasn't falling for it. So he suggested we go for a walk.
He wasn't put off at all, or so it seemed, and I was really attracted to him. It filled me with so much confusion and guilt, but also this passion I hadn't felt for so long. He was inside my head. I don't know how else to describe it.
We went down this side street. He said he wanted to show me something. It was some kind of gallery. It was closed, of course, and the street was empty. It was after midnight.
He showed me this painting in the window. He said his friend painted it. Total bullshit, I found out. The artist was dead. But that's not the point. Sylvia leaned in close, lowered her voice. Her eyes scanned the small dining room, which was still as empty as it had been when Rosie had arrived.
There was an alley between the art gallery and the next building. That was why he'd brought me there. He grabbed my hand and pulled me just inside between the buildings, just a little bit.
so little that I still felt visible from the street. He said he couldn't stand not kissing me for one more second. And then he did. He kissed me. And it was just like the way he got into my head and took over my thoughts. He did that to the rest of me in that alley, to my body. It was all so gradual, so natural and perfect that I didn't even know what was happening, really, until my face was pressed against the side of that building and he was inside me.
She stopped then, closed her eyes and shook her head quickly, as though trying to erase the memory that was before her now. When she opened her eyes again, she blinked away tears.
I want to be clear, though. He didn't assault me. There was no force. Just brilliant seduction. He made me want him. He clearly expected sex on the third date, and he got it.
Rosie reached across the table and took her hand. I'm so sorry. She meant it. But still, this couldn't be the end. This couldn't just be about seduction and regret. Unless her fears were right. Unless Laura's regret had turned to rage. Can I ask you what happened after that? If you saw him again? Sylvia slid her hand away and folded it into her lap.
Everything changed. As soon as he had my face pressed against that wall, everything tender and loving about him turned ugly. He started saying things to me, in my ear. Dirty talk, they call it, but I had never heard it that dirty. That filthy and degrading. He bit down on my earlobe until it bled. And he was so rough and crude. When it was over, he couldn't wait to get rid of me. He barely waited for me to straighten my clothes. He zipped up his pants and started walking. I had to run to catch up to him.
Jesus, Rosie said, imagining the scene.
Look, I'm not naive, and it's not the first time I've been in a situation that wasn't, you know, a relationship. I'm not the girl who thinks every guy she sleeps with wants to marry her.
Sylvia pressed her hand on the man's picture.
But this man is sick. He walked ahead of me the whole way back to the restaurant. He said something like, thanks. And then he walked away, just like that. He didn't walk me to my car. He didn't kiss me goodnight. He was making a point of it, like he wanted to make sure he made me feel as used as he possibly could. I don't think it was about the sex. He wanted to hurt me. But that's not all.
She laughed then, a maniacal burst that came from deep inside her.
I waited 2 days before texting him, the worst 2 days of my life. The facts were all there, and the feeling in my gut as well, but I clung to this shred of hope that I was wrong, that he was just awkward or kinky or something, but that the rest of it, the conversation and the way he looked at me and made me feel, was genuine. Because if I was that wrong about him, if I could be so easily manipulated, then the world felt like it was turned upside down. Like nothing was real.
Rosie didn't know what to say, so she said nothing. She was picturing Laura with this man, wondering if she would be able to see through it. She was so good at that, at seeing people. Unless they were men offering the hope of love.
You probably think I'm just an idiot,
Sylvia said after a short while.
No, Rosie said. That's not what I was thinking. We can't live our lives never trusting anyone. That would be miserable.
Well, maybe so. But when I finally texted him, the number was unrecognizable. It was gone. Some kind of burner phone, track phone, disposable. His names were all fakes. He was done with me, and he made sure I had no way to find him. I tried. Google, Facebook, other social apps. He was gone. And I was left with my guilt and shame. But also, you know what?
What? Rosie asked.
Gratitude. For Dan. For that boring guy who sits on the couch watching football and doesn't hear a word I say, but loves me and is honest and loyal and doesn't call me a cunt when we're making love. That man, Billy or Buck or Jonathan or whoever the hell he is, he's sick and he's a liar. He's never who he says he is. But I try now to think of him as a gift. Because he showed me what kind of monsters are out there. Promise me, she said then, taking hold of Rosie's arm this time. Promise me that you will never tell anyone about this. I can't lose what I have. Not over this. Please.
Of course, Rosie reassured her. I won't say a word. But can you just sit with me a little longer? Tell me more things about him. The stories he told, things he said about his past, anything. It might help me find him. And then find my sister. Sylvia nodded.
Okay, she said. But then you have to promise me another thing.
Name it.
I'm not a vengeful person. Or a violent person. But if you do find him, I want to know who he is, she said. And somehow, I want him to pay.
Chapter 19. Laura. Session number 11. 2 months ago. New York City. Dr. Brody.
It can become confused in the mind. Intimacy and sex. Power and sex.
Laura. You sound like an article in Cosmo. Dr. Brody.
I know. It's cliche. Do you remember when it changed? You used to find power through other things, chasing vampires and climbing trees, even school and sports.
Laura. Jumping through hoops? Dr. Brody.
Maybe. But it changed, didn't it? What brought that change?
Laura. It'll sound absurd to you. Dr. Brody.
Try me.
Laura. It was a kiss. Everything changed with one kiss. Chapter 20. Laura. The night before. Thursday, 10:30 p.m. Branston, Connecticut. Jonathan Fielding lives in a nice building, with navy blue carpeting in the hallways and beige wallpaper. All of the trim is gold, so it looks elegant and fancy. Maybe a bit old-fashioned, but that's normal for this town. We don't speak in the elevator. We don't speak as we walk down the hall to his door, or when he finds the key and puts it in the lock, turns the knob, and lets us in.
Here it is,
he says finally.
A home sweet home.
Only it's not sweet at all. And it doesn't feel like anybody's home. It's close to empty. He deciphers my expression and makes a preemptive excuse.
I know, I know.
His hands are held up in front of him, head bowed like he's making an apology, humble, contrite.
I haven't had time to get it properly furnished.
That's an understatement. I walk in and look wall to wall. On the left is the kitchen. It's very white and clean, as though it rarely gets used. There is nothing on the counter except takeout menus and plastic silverware. Not even a salt shaker. Not even a dirty glass he didn't have time to put in the dishwasher. Dead center is the living room. There's a small sofa against the wall. It's black leather and has no pillows. It faces the opposing wall, where a very large television sits on the floor, propped up on a temporary stand. It's waiting to be hung. Beside it is a cable box with some wires going into the wall. There is nothing else. Not a coffee table, not a painting or a picture or a rug. Absolutely nothing. Okay, I say skeptically, as I gather this information along with the other things he's told me over the past 3 hours. He said he's been divorced for a year. He said he lived here even before that and worked here as well. He said he only commuted to the city a few times a month. More things add to my list of concerns, with the car and the woman. Yes, I add her back on the list now. And the fact that he stayed here voluntarily, in this small town where he has to get dates on a website. I begin my inquisition. So tell me you moonlight for the CIA. He laughs nervously, throws his keys on the bare kitchen counter. They make a loud noise as they slide across it. There's nothing on the counter to stop them.
What?
He asks. You've been here a year, and all you have is one sofa? Didn't you get anything from your old house? I thought people divided things up when they got divorced. Eyebrows raised, tilted head, wry smile. That crooked smile. Is it endearing? Or was I wrong before? Is it smug?
I know. I didn't want any of it. It all reminded me of her and our life together. It's not like I still love her or anything, but it is the death of a dream, right? The dream I had of a family and all that.
Jonathan Fielding, you can do better than that, can't you? But then you didn't just make a run to IKEA and load up. Do you even have any dishes? Jonathan Fielding opens a cupboard and points proudly to a set of white plates and glass tumblers.
You want a drink?
He asks, changing the subject. Sure, I say, but I return to the subject. Seriously, you've really been here for a year, living like this? He has a bottle of scotch and pours two glasses.
I know it's pathetic. Maybe we can go to IKEA on our next date, assuming you still want to have one. I do. I know that much.
He hands me the scotch and leads me to the sofa in the otherwise empty room. We sit on opposite ends. Still, it's small, and when he pulls one knee up onto the cushions, he's one lean away from me.
Tell me more about the fun things, the good things, he says. It sounds like you have great memories of your childhood, with your sister and her husband and the other kids in the neighborhood. It must have been incredible to grow up next to all those woods.
Well, when you put it that way. I guess it was happy in some ways. I say this, and I somehow even believe it. Yet the word happy is not quite right. I try to clarify. It's strange, though. I can pick out certain moments that, in my mind, right now, play back as joyful. Like, oh my God, how we used to tightrope across this enormous fallen tree, and right below it was the nastiest pool of mud and skunk cabbage you can imagine. I nearly fell in it once, but I dug my nails into the bark of that tree so hard that I was able to hang on and shinny to the other side. Joy. But then other times, I remember this unrest that was always there, casting a shadow on everything. Anger.
Well, that was your father, right? Your mother knowing he was cheating, crying in the kitchen to your neighbor. What was her name?
Mrs. Wallace. Gabe's mother.
Right. Of course you were unsettled. Your very foundation was like quicksand.
I nod solemnly. It was all Dick's fault. So neat and tidy. I change back to the joy. I had my first kiss in those woods.
Really?
He says, and I feel him shift a little closer. I didn't mean to be provocative, but now it's too late. It was nothing romantic, believe me. There were 7 or 8 of us. We were playing spin the bottle by this fort we'd made with a piece of plywood.
Very high tech.
Yes, very, I say, smiling now. Rosie and Joe weren't there. I'd brought 2 friends home from school. Gabe was there. His brother Rick, but only because of this girl, Noelle, who also lived on our street at the time and was in Rick's grade. I think she had a friend as well. Jonathan Fielding adjusts himself with nonchalance, but manages to move a little closer.
How old were you?
14, maybe. Joe and Rosie were together by then, so they were 16 and 17. Gabe was 16 as well. His brother was about 18. I don't know, we were all teenagers.
A giant pool of raging hormones.
Ugh. I cringe at the image he's put before me. Anyway, there were 3 boys there. One of them I didn't even know, and I can't remember his name. Can you believe that? The first boy I ever kissed, and I don't even know his name.
That always seemed strange to me, that game. Kissing friends in front of other people, then watching them kiss other friends.
I only played that one time, but I didn't like any of the boys that way, and thank God the bottle never landed on Gabe. He was my best friend, so that would have been awkward. This was not entirely true. I would come to like one of those boys after that day, if like and desire are one and the same.
I'm just saying, as a guy, that it would have been more than weird. He would never have looked at you the same way.
He was like my big brother. so I don't think he would have even done it. It would be like kissing Joe. Can you imagine if he'd been there? Jesus. A little closer now, with a shift of his leg, a move of his elbow.
It sounds a little incestuous, your neighborhood, growing up together like that, and then Rosie and Joe getting married. They know everything about each other. Sometimes I think it's good to have some things you keep to yourself, or only share with people you aren't involved with, people who can be objective.
And who won't use your past to win arguments over who is to take out the garbage.
Exactly.
Awkward silence. I drink more scotch. Thank God for scotch. He takes my glass. He gets up and goes to the kitchen. I hear ice cubes. I hear them crack when the liquor hits them.
So you kissed that one guy whose name you don't remember, but not Gabe. And the other boy who was there, Gabe's brother?
He returns, hands me the drink. Sits noticeably closer, and I realize he got us refills for this sole purpose. There have been many kisses since that first kiss. I know what's what.
Yeah, Rick.
He was a bad kid, down to his bones. He spent 9 months a year at military school in Virginia, but he came home for a few summers. His mother used to cry about him to my mother in our kitchen. She was actually relieved when he joined the army.
And you had to kiss this guy?
Yeah. Kind of killed the whole first kiss thing. The guy I didn't know, and the guy I wished I didn't know. But it was really short. He was a little scared of me, to be honest.
Scared of you? Why?
A few years before, I... Heart pounds. Wave of adrenaline. Fight or flight reaction surges in an instant. The human body in top form. I can't tell this story, but now I've started it. I go for a modification. I used to tell on him when he was mean to us. I think I'm the reason he got sent away to military school.
Oh, shit. He must have hated you.
I don't care. He used to pick fights with everyone all the time, even his brother. One was pretty bad. I saw him fighting with Gabe by the fort, and I started yelling that I would tell their mother. Rick threw one last punch, then ran off. Told me to go fuck myself first, which was nice since I was only 11.
And then a few years later, you kissed him.
I pretend that wasn't really a question and move on. Okay, I say with the most engaging smile I know how to make. Your turn. First kiss. Jonathan Fielding starts to tell a sweet story about some crush he had in 9th grade. It's a script from an after-school special. But my mind is reeling, so his words bounce away. Rick Wallace. The bottle spins, starts to slow. I see it turn past Gabe and the nameless guy, and I cannot believe what is in my heart. I hate Rick Wallace. I hate how he used to terrorize us. It slows more as it passes Noel. I remember the look on his face when I hit him with that stick, when he felt the power of my rage. It stops. It points to Rick Wallace. Gabe starts to get up, but there is no time for him to stop it. We move to the center of the circle. Rick grabs the back of my head and kisses me with more than his mouth. He kisses me with years of his own hatred, with fantasies of vengeance. I can feel it all in the heat of his breath. But then I feel something else. His body responding to my mouth, my breath, telling the hatred it will have to wait. That day when I was 14, I felt, for the very first time, the power of sexual desire. Until then, until that moment, I had been the girl who acted like a boy, who had fists for hands, who climbed trees that swung out over our house and punched holes in walls and swore like a truck driver, horrible obscenities flying from my little pink lips. Shock and awe. I had an arsenal of weapons to use against anyone who dared be my enemy, to use against the enemy inside myself. The unrest, the longing. But nothing as powerful as this one. I left the fort, left the woods, left Rick Wallace, and I ran home as fast as my legs would carry me. But I did not outrun it. That night I dreamt about Rick Wallace, about his mouth on my mouth and his hands on my body, I dreamed of his body releasing the hatred relinquishing its power in the face of this greater force, this desire. And what was left in its place was the one thing I craved. Love. Jonathan Fielding's voice had left the room. The story ended. "That's a nicer story than mine," I say, even though I haven't heard one word of it. Still, it's a pretty safe bet. Silence. Longing stare.
"I want to kiss you,"
Jonathan Fielding says. I don't say yes. I don't say no. He leans across the sofa. He only has one hand free because he's holding his drink. It pushes against the drink in my hand, and scotch spills on the black leather. He takes my glass in his other hand, and he places our glasses on the bare floor. With both hands now, he gently takes my head like it's a baby bird and pulls me to him. He closes his eyes, but mine stay open. His breath touches my cheek. His mouth is on my mouth. His hands hold my face. And it all rushes over me, a tidal wave, a mudslide. I've been kissed a million times. I've been through it a million times. Still, it washes me away. We move through the stages. I know them well. Lips pressed together, soft, almost still. A breath taken and released. Heat. We come together again, this time lips part. A breath shared. A hand moves from my face to the back of my head, fingers in my hair, palm closing, taking hold of me. Desire pounding at the door as his tongue sweeps over mine. This gentle kiss growing furious with passion. Love. Evasive love, always running away. But now a kiss, full of promise. I close my eyes and feel the surge of power, the intoxication. It is so familiar. I think of Rick Wallace lying on the ground. I think of Mitch Adler lying on the ground. Jonathan Fielding. What to do with this kiss, with the promises it makes? I don't even know you. It's too soon for promises. I know I have no right. But I hate you now for making them.
Chapter 21. Rosie, present day, Saturday, 2 a.m., Branston, Connecticut. What would Laura do? Rosie thought about the story as she drove home. The seduction. The brilliant seduction. The hours of talking, getting inside Sylvia Emmett's head. He made her feel something for him just so he could viciously take it away, so he could make her hate herself more than she hated him. Laura would have been a moth to a flame, talking and talking, interpreting his words in a way that satisfied some fantasy of him. And then a kiss. That's how it always began. Why can't you just leave it at that? See what happens. See if he's worth it. It was easy to give advice, stand on higher moral ground. And it was easy to judge. Laura and her wolves. She pulled into the driveway and turned off the car. Then she sat, thinking. What would Laura feel? A kiss that got inside her, that found the need. She would be hopeful. She would lose herself to it. And if he walked away, indifferent, making sure she knew that he had deceived her? What would Rosie do if Joe walked away after a lifetime of friendship? After they'd become lovers? If one night they made love and then he told her he didn't care? If he told her he didn't want to be with her? She tried to imagine it. Joe had been devoted from the first moment she'd held his eyes a second longer than she ever had before. In the hallway of their school, talking like they always had. In a circle of friends. She'd caught him looking at her, and she'd known. It had been so easy. She'd looked back and held his eyes. It had made him blush, and that night he had kissed her for the first time. But what if that had not been the case? What would she have done?
What if there was another scenario?
She would have turned to that boy in her history class who was always flirting with her. She would have flirted back and maybe even gone out with him just to make Joe see that she had options, that she had moved on. That's what people do, right? Laura would need something different. If she didn't turn to violence, she would walk away, filled with pride. She would not let this stranger, this old divorced man from a website, think he'd hurt her. But then, when he was gone and she had no way to find him again, the anger would build, and she would need a target. Someone else who'd hurt her and hadn't paid. The man in New York. Asshole. Laura had left with no resolution, no answer. But unlike Jonathan Fields, she knew where to find this one. Rosie rushed inside, to her computer this time, at a small desk in the corner of the kitchen. She knew his first name, Kevin, but nothing more. They'd tried to find him earlier with no luck. The two friends she'd called, Jill from work and the roommate Kathleen, hadn't known either. But now she had a thought. She went into her emails and searched for him. 7 old messages came on the screen, all from Laura. She knew which one she was looking for. It was from May, at the start of things. She was with him at a hotel across the street from his office. She'd told Rosie the name. And there it was. Laura, guess where I am?
Rosie, work? It's Tuesday at 3.
Laura, I'm drinking champagne at the West Hotel. Kevin only had an hour.
Rosie, I thought you said he was good in bed.
Laura, ha ha, he works across the street, so he had the whole hour.
Rosie, jealous.
She hadn't been jealous. She'd been worried. Laura was on a high, emailing and texting with details about her adventures with this new man, Kevin. She kept saying that he was different, that he was good to her, that he loved her. But she seemed manic, anxious. Her words were different, but her mood was the same as with all the others. Rosie logged into the findlove.com account and clicked on the search they'd used to get those pictures, the ones with Jonathan Fields. Divorced, 35 to 40, income, $150,000 plus. She hadn't noticed it earlier, but she could see it now. Jonathan Fields was the best-looking man on the page. He looked younger than 40. And there was something about him, the smug smile, the way his head tilted. It was arrogance. He reminded her of all the others. Most of all, the last one Rosie had known, the one from Laura's junior year, Mitch Adler. He'd tortured Laura all summer, casting her down a long, winding roller coaster that hadn't stopped until the night of the party, that night in the woods. Rosie had seen it unfolding. He'd come with another girl, a sophomore from the public high school, his school. He'd made sure Laura saw them together. Rosie had been on the other side of the fire with her friends, with the older kids who were in college. She'd glanced over now and again to check on Laura, the way she always had. She'd seen Mitch walking up the path, this new girl right behind him. Laura had pretended not to see. She'd found some friends near a cooler of beer. When Rosie had looked again, Laura was gone. So was Mitch, but the new girl was by the fire, forlorn. There had been a game playing out, and Rosie had known it wouldn't end well. But she had been so tired of it. Tired of being Laura's babysitter. She had not looked across the fire again until she'd heard the scream. Rosie checked the time. It was 4 a.m. The room was still. Outside, nothing but darkness. The world was asleep, but time was not. She heard the clock tick above the sink, relentlessly. Every second that passed felt like another step deeper into a life where Laura was never found. She got up, grabbed her keys, her purse, and headed back to the car. The West Hotel was on 9th Avenue between West 23rd and West 22nd. Rosie was there by 5:30. She parked on the next side street, then walked back to the front of the building. She looked up at the windows and imagined Laura looking out from one of them, sipping champagne, watching for her new love to step outside his office and make his way to her. Kevin? She didn't even have a last name. She turned to face the buildings across the street. A cab drove by, then a delivery truck, the metal ladder pinned to the side clanking as the truck hit a pothole. The sky was orange with the morning sun. Time was slipping away. She started at the top of the block, reading the names on the sides of the buildings that had offices. How was it possible that she hadn't asked what he did or how they'd met? Just like that night at the fire, she had grown tired of looking after her sister. There could easily be 200 people who worked on this block. Dental offices. A deli. She didn't care how long it took, or how crazy she felt. Exhaustion was spinning her thoughts. Apartments. A donut shop. She went inside and got a coffee. "Have you seen this woman?" she asked the man at the counter, showing him Laura's picture from her phone. He shook his head. "How about a man named Kevin who works on this block?" Nothing. She didn't have a picture. Why would she? She hadn't bothered to ask for one, hadn't wanted to know. She had not wanted to see the train go off the tracks. She took a long sip of the coffee, then snapped on the lid. Back outside, a print shop, more apartments, a dry cleaner. She heard herself asking the questions. "Do you know a man named Kevin? Do you know this woman?" Some faces reflected the absurdity. Others mirrored her concern and asked if she was all right. Others still answered quickly, then fled. She could be anyone. She could be dangerous. Each doorway, each building, some reaching into the sky with dozens of offices on each floor. She stopped and asked anyone she could find. She was careful not to miss anything. An hour passed, then another. The sky was light. She'd expanded her search 2 blocks both north and south. So many buildings were still closed. On the verge of starting down a new block, she looked back up the street and spotted a woman opening a building that had been closed when she'd passed it. She ran to the doorway and slipped inside before it could close again. The building was right in the middle of the block, right across the street from the hotel, like Laura had said. Rosie searched a directory that hung by the elevators, searching the names, searching for one name. Kevin. They were healthcare offices, all different kinds, from massage therapists to orthopedists. And then, there it was, the name she'd been looking for all morning. Dr. Kevin Brody, PhD, clinical psychology. Christ, Laura. She had been expecting a banker or lawyer, someone Laura would cross paths with at her job. But a doctor? A shrink? And then a worse thought. Her shrink? She rang the buzzer, knowing before she did that no one would answer. It was barely coming up on 8 a.m., and it was Saturday. But the hotel? She rushed across the street and through the revolving door. A young man was at the desk just inside.
"Have you seen this woman? I think she stayed here a few times over the summer," Rosie asked.
She held her phone up with Laura's picture. The man took the phone and looked closely.
"I don't know. Maybe. I work the night shift and it's really quiet. I rarely see any of the guests."
"She might have come in late Thursday night."
"Definitely not then. I worked that night and I would have remembered. She's really pretty. Is she in trouble?"
Rosie looked back to the street and the building where Dr. Kevin Brody worked. She could see her reflection in the glass right beside it. Sweatpants. T-shirt. She hadn't brushed her hair or showered for almost 2 days. But it was the anguish on her face that was shocking.
"She might be. She's missing," Rosie said. "I think her boyfriend worked across the street."
"Do you have his picture?" the man asked.
Rosie grabbed her phone and Googled Dr. Kevin Brody, NYC. An image popped up from a professional website. She was about to enlarge it and show it to the man at the desk. But then she saw something else. An article just beneath it from the Post. "Local doctor killed in robbery." Rosie's hand clenched her mouth. She clicked on the article and scanned the contents. It was one paragraph. "He was assaulted outside his gym. His wallet and phone were stolen, as well as his gym bag. He died of injuries sustained during the attack."
And then the last sentence, striking Rosie right in the gut. The beloved doctor leaves behind a wife and two small children.
Chapter 22. Laura. Session number 13. 2 months ago. New York City. Dr. Brody.
Change begins with understanding your blind spots. It begins with recognition that something's wrong, even if you're drawn to it.
Laura. You mean to them, don't you? The men I'm drawn to, starting with Mitch Adler. Dr. Brody.
Think about what he asked you to do, how he treated you. It was about power, and you kept giving it to him. You didn't see that it was insatiable, that he was never going to give you what you wanted.
Laura. But I thought he would. Dr. Brody.
Because he fed you just enough to make you believe. And when he did, it made you feel powerful. You said it felt intoxicating, like a drug. Can you see the pattern?
Laura. And what about now, Kevin? Am I doing it again? Dr. Brody.
We need to be careful, Laura. The lines are starting to blur.